Law and Policy, and welcome to our podcast. Tibet is considered the Buddhist capital of China, causing many not familiar with China's geography to believe that Buddhism came to China from India through Tibet. But with the highest mountain peaks in the world, the Himalayas, separating India and China, Buddhism had to take a different route. Instead, it entered northern China through what has become known as the Silk Road. As a result, some very early Buddhist art can be found in remote northwestern regions of China. One such example are the Buddhist cave art in Dunhuang, an oasis town situated in the Gobi Desert. The Mogao Caves are probably the best known. But any trip to the Mogao Caves by a Buddhist art novice leaves one with many questions on the art, the history, and its significance. Fortunately, China Law and Policy had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Neil Schmid, an American expert on Buddhist studies and Dunhuang. Thank you for joining us today. First, can you give us a little bit of background on the caves? When were they first constructed, why, and by whom?
Elizabeth, thank you for inviting me. So there's a story, maybe apocryphal, that in 366, a monk by the name of Ledzun had a vision. And this is a vision that happened outside of the oasis of Dunhuang in a small ravine with a cliff face. And there he had this vision that he was basically to build a cave, dig a cave. And so this is, again, maybe it's apocryphal, but this is the originating story of the Mogao Caves.
And what year was that again?
366.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And so he was followed by another monk, Fa Liang, and then a series of monks after that.
And so can you explain more, like, why these caves were created?
Well, as I said, initially they were dug out as meditation spaces. So spaces where monks could live relatively distanced from Dunhuang or some sort of urban or town center, and do spiritual practices. And this is the origin of these caves. And then what happens over time, over the centuries, is that the site becomes a pilgrimage site. And with these powerful monks, spiritually, that is, people began to patronize them. And in doing so, they began to build caves themselves. And these people were typically the elites or also groups of people who would gather together and fund the digging and the construction of a cave in Mogao, in this area. You asked about whom they were actually built by, right? So they had funders, they had donors, but there was, and we have a lot of information from the 10th century on, but we have... We know that it was a professional class of artisans who actually did the construction work, painters, sculptors, metalsmiths, textile workers, and they were organized hierarchically according to their expertise, and their titles reflected their skill and their standing. So these are the people who actually built the caves, and we can talk a little bit later about that process of building itself.
Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting that you talk about the professional class of artisans and also just the changes over who was sponsoring the building over centuries. And I guess, like, when you go to the Mogao Caves themselves, you do see some changes to the art when you visit different caves. Can you explain more, maybe, or highlight what some of those changes are from the beginning to the later parts? And do you believe there's a high point to the art itself?
Mm-hmm. So the earliest caves we have are from the northern Liang, and that's 397 to 439. And these caves are very, very heavily influenced by Indian and also Central Asian styles. The motifs, the iconography, the sculpture is very, very much dominated by something other than Chinese. And over the years, these artistic forms and iconography and also the ritual space itself begins to shift away from monks towards an increasingly lay-oriented perspective. And so what the caves also take on in terms of transformation of the styles, the artistic styles and ritual styles, is an increasingly Sinicized, i.e. Chinese, aesthetic. And so, for example, what happens later is you have stories about India and about the Buddha done completely in Chinese costume, in Chinese-like settings, and it naturalizes in some ways Buddhism for Chinese, and we see this very clearly evidenced in the caves.
And do you believe, like, at any point, I mean, I know some art historians believe that some dynasties had better art than others, or higher end art than others. Do you believe that, I mean, do you agree with that? Is there any dynastic, I mean, I think everybody always thinks the Tang Dynasty, but how would you, how do you deal with that? Do you believe there's any part that's...
No, that's a good question. I mean, I could talk about my personal favorites, you know.
It's okay.
But, thanks. But, I mean, I particularly like Tang, what's known as High Tang style. But it's very, very difficult to say one style is a high point. It, obviously, it depends on the reference points of what you consider, you know, a high point. I mean, there's amazing artistic skills that go into the creation of earlier caves in terms of actual painting styles and things like that, which are now lost in China. So in some ways, you could say, oh, due to the introduction and then disappearance, these were high points in particular artistic styles.
Right,
and
right. So, okay, that's fair. I mean, I guess the other thing is when visiting the caves, I think you can't help but wonder, like, how starting in 400 AD, people were able to paint and build such amazing art. And, I mean, in particular, there's that one awe-inspiring Buddha. Do we know exactly, like, how these caves were built, how the painting was put onto the walls, and how many people it took to build these caves? And I think you were already talking a little bit about the professionalization of the artisans. I mean, if you could go into a little bit more depth about that.
Sure. So what happens after in the Tang and also Five Dynasties period and also in the Song is that you have elite families funding the construction of caves. And in the process, they create what is essentially a painting academy. And at this painting academy, you have trained artisans. And note that they're laity, they're not monks, they're not clerics. And so we have lots and lots of documentation from this period and detailed manuscripts about what they were paid, how often they were paid, you know, where they lived, etc. The types of work, their individual specialties, and we know that laborers were typically paid in food, so cooked meals, also oil, also grains, and so this was a typical form of payment. And how the caves themselves were actually constructed? They were constructed by starting at the top of the interior of a cave, and then digging it out and down. And so what they would do then after it was dug out is they would begin to sort of burnish, if you will, the walls, and then apply a straw and stucco mix. And then on top of that, begin the painting process. In this period, very late Tang, Five Dynasties period, Song period, it became very programmatic and very organized in terms of the pictorial program of the caves themselves, and very standardized. And they used a variety of drawings, for example, to create on a regular basis the paintings in the caves. They also used something called pounces, which is a piece of paper with dots cut in that they would then typically blow a paint across to get an outline, and then they would color that in.
Yeah.
So one of the motifs you see again and again at Dunhuang in the Mogao Caves is the Thousand Buddha motif.
Right. You see, like,
exactly.
So they did it in, like, an assembly line.
Exactly. So there's this whole modularity to the construction and also the painting process. And then the paints themselves are typically used things like the expensive ones, lapis lazuli and malachite and things like this. So the painting was done on dry stucco and again through a series of artisans. And the construction of a cave, a large cave during this period would be perhaps a year. So it would take a year to do this.